Welcome to Callings, a podcast of NetView, the network for vocation in undergraduate education, featuring conversations on college, career, and a life well lived. I'm Erin Van Lanningham.
And I'm Hannah Schill.
We invite you to explore with us and our guests the process of discovering one's vocation. We approach the subject with eagerness and humility, and the recognition that a diversity of viewpoints, religious and secular, influence how we understand vocation. Through these conversations, we hope to offer listeners better ways to understand how discerning one's purpose in connection with others is central to a meaningful life. Hannah, let's introduce today's guests.
Our guests today are Mark Schwain and Dorothy Bass. Mark Schwain is a senior research fellow and professor of humanities at Christ College, the Honors College of Valparaiso University, where he has taught since 1983. Mark served as dean of Christ College from 1990 to 2003, and then as provost and executive vice president for academic affairs from 2009 until 2014. He's the author of Exiles from Eden, Religion and the Academic Vocation in America, published in 1993, as well as numerous essays about higher education, faith, and the academy. His essay, Good Teaching, Character Formation and Vocational Discernment, appeared in the second NetView collection, Vocation Across the Academy.
He is joined by Dorothy Bast, who directed the Valparaiso Project on the Education and Formation of People in Faith, a Lilly Endowment project for 25 years. She is the author of numerous essays and several books, including On Our Way, Christian Practices for Living a Whole Life, published in 2010, and Practicing Our Faith, A Way of Life for a Searching People, and Receiving the Day, Christian Practices for Opening the Gift of Time, both recently republished in new editions by Fortress Press. She is presently a senior fellow in the Lilly Fellows Program in the Humanities and the Arts at Valparaiso University. Most of our listeners will know Mark and Dorothy as the co-editors of the book Leading Lives That Matter. An updated second edition was published this summer, and we are eager to hear more about that project.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
We're glad to have you. So we're NetView, so we're interested in vocation stories. And depending on what you'd be willing to share, we're hearing from each of you about when you experienced a sense of calling. Is there a particular moment of epiphany or setback or a crossroads in your life that you can point to and share with us?
It might take me a minute.
It's fine.
Yeah. Okay.
I can go first. I mean, I'm one of those people for whom there was no one single moment of epiphany, but whose sense of calling dawned on me simply as a part of my growing up and part of every other part of maturation. Largely because I come from a long line of Lutheran ministers, all of whose oldest sons became themselves ministers. So I was always simply presumed to be, and always presumed I would be, a minister, or at least serving in some broad sense the church. I like to joke and say I was preordained. And so basically, my gradual epiphanies, I should say my epiphany took place, I think, when I got to college, intending to prepare to go from there to seminary, and fell in love with teaching and fell in love with learning, and basically reoriented my sense of vocation from being a preacher to being a teacher in a church-related context. In other words, I shifted not the larger sense of vocation, serving particularly the church, but the actual way in which I felt called to do that, which was not any longer being a pastor, but instead being a professor and a writer. But I never lost the aspiration, even when I felt the calling to be a teacher, to want to carry forward that teaching and learning in a church-related context.
My story is not unrelated, though we didn't meet till we were in our 30s and both were teaching humanities in the University of Chicago. Girls were not going to be preordained. And at that time, very few churches allowed the ordination of women. I believe that I would have taken that track had it been open to me. But when I got to college and started studying theology, I saw a good alternative, which was to study religion in the academy and then to teach it to young people. And that's what I did. My degree is in American Studies. After receiving that degree, I did teach for a couple of years in the humanities in Chicago and then became a seminary professor. Did that for 10 years and was tenured and felt deeply, deeply called to that mix of care for the church and really deep immersion in the academy as well. After 10 years of that, Lilly Endowment invited me to develop a project on faith in the contemporary world that would be directed primarily to ordinary Christian people. And that's what I did for the next 25 years. We also worked with seminary professors primarily, but some college professors as well, to develop other kinds of writing and resources, which would serve that purpose. And that was my most important life work, I think. It was in that context, when I was doing that work of developing a literature for Christian people, and Mark was working in the academy, that Lilly Endowment invited us to work together to develop Leading Lives That Matter.
So shifting to talking about the book, Leading Lives That Matter, What We Should Do and Who We Should Be, this book, I think, has influenced many undergraduates and their professors, especially in first-year seminars, but not necessarily only there, across the curriculum and across many different disciplines. We're wondering, what was the root or inspiration for the original edition? Sounds like you were invited to put this together, but is there a wider story there that you can share?
By that time, at the time when we were invited early in this century to develop this book, Lilly Endowment had already funded, 88 colleges and universities to do programs exploring vocation theologically. And that was including our own university, Valparaiso. And they felt that some new resources were needed to be used in the classrooms that were involved in and finding great interest in that question of vocation. So they invited us and William Plaker, of beloved memory, who was a theology professor at Wabash College and a historian of Christian thought. They invited him to work on one volume, which would primarily trace Christian thinking about vocation across the centuries. And then they invited us to do what you might call an interdisciplinary humanities book that would do something similar, which would explore questions of meaning and significance in a way that would be exciting to college students by gathering excellent texts from a range of perspectives. And so we worked with Erdmans and with Bill Plaker and with one another to develop those different but mutually supportive texts.
I think the other part of this backstory, which is explained a little bit in the preface to the first edition, which is also included in the second edition, is that I was teaching upper division seminars in Christ College, the Honors College here. And for those, we can choose our own topic. And so when this opportunity arose, the topic of my seminar was called What Makes a Life Significant, with this book and its preparation in mind. And I thought if this was going to be aimed especially, but by no means exclusively, at young men and women as they were trying to discern what they were going to do for earning a living, as well as what they were going to do in terms of its meaning and significance and purpose in the larger scheme of things, I wanted to use them as basically a research team to generate the kinds of questions that were most urgent to them, which would then be the organizing chapters of the book, and having generated those questions, to then be field research teams to go out and find readings that might be put under those various questions. Obviously, I had assigned some readings, including the William James essay, What Makes a Life Significant, to get the course started, and gave them a number of ideas about how to do the research. But basically, the class then became a kind of combination focus group to test out readings, and editorial team to choose them, because we then read the readings that the students themselves brought to the table. And so, in other words, the book was, in a sense, by students, for students, and their parents, because I asked them always to not only just envision themselves, but the kinds of things their parents were struggling with. And so that was the other important part of that story.
I love hearing the collaboration with students to kind of get this going from the ground up. And I think that speaks to its success in the classroom, because students were part of it from the beginning. That's really insightful and inspiring thing to hear. Switching to talking about this new edition, the second edition, we're wondering how long this has been in process, what motivated it. And we have some questions about, you know, you're moving the sections around and talking about some of the different vocabularies. But if we can start by just talking about what motivated working on the second edition, and how has that process gone, and, you know, what were some stories about that?
We first thought of this because Erdmann's, the editors at Erdmann's, the publisher, called us and said, we're going to have to renew the permission to publish all those works. And if we're going to do that, let's think about it. Would we like to add some others? Or, you know, and that getting permission to use all these texts is a huge job, which Erdmann's handled for us this time. So that's what they wanted to know. And they said, this has been selling well. It's clear the people value it. Would you like to do a second edition? And we said, yes, we would. Wouldn't all of us like to have a do-over on even our best work, you know? And in the meantime, really, it had been out there for 14 years or so. And many of our friends around the country, including some NetView people and others, had been, and we had our own little file, other things that would be really great to include if we could. Actually, I don't think there'll be a third edition, but I just found something for that same folder last week. So we had a stock of things to think about. We knew what, and then we did a very systematic attempt to find people who had used the book and ask them what they found helpful, what they didn't find helpful, which texts they would want to be sure we never deleted, and which ones they would like to, they thought were not very valuable. And we did that. We put out questions in newsletters and so on. And then we jumped in and read new things. And it was very fun, actually.
Yes. And of course, once we got the invitation, we started thinking right away about what had changed over the 15 years that put certain matters that were present already then, but not nearly as prominently on the table, that had a bearing on the broader questions about how to lead lives of meaning and purpose and so forth. And of course, one of them that loomed up right away was the whole question of the environment and the ecology and what's happening to the planet in peril. How does one think about a life going forward when one is living in a situation of global catastrophe in terms of the environment? I mean, think of the poor people, even as we're having this interview. 10% of the state of Oregon has been evacuated from their homes, not to speak of California and so forth. And all of these various catastrophes had already begun to gain momentum in terms of hurricanes and other signs that people could actually see of climate change. And so we really wanted to add a section on that, which had not been in the first edition. And we also got a lot of other commentary, and this is the chapter I think Dorothy worked hardest on, that it was strange how we talked very much about, we wanted to insist that vocation was in some sense communal, but we always talked only in the first person. So we basically noted that and remedied it in part by having this whole new chapter on community, in effect. And those were the two things that surfaced most often in conversation with others, but also that surfaced just in the headlines as you picked up the newspaper every day, that we need, that we really desperately wanted to remedy this this second time around.
Mm-hmm. For those listening, chapter five is entitled, "What Are My Obligations to Future Human and Other Life?" That's the question that's posed, and there are wide range of readings there that Mark is referring to. I want to cycle back and talk about the beginning of the edition in the section entitled Vocabularies. And the vocabularies listed are authenticity, virtue, exemplarity, and vocation. And I'm wondering if one of these vocabularies speaks to you in particular. Can you say, you know, something about this fourth category, exemplarity? We'd be really interested to hear your insights about this particular section.
Well, I think the one that speaks most directly to me is, of course, vocation. And the task of the first part was to simply, since the point of the book was to bring vocational conversation into conversation with other traditions and other ways of thinking about how to lead lives of meaning and significance and purpose, it was just important, we thought, for students to see the different ways in which people actually do talk about how to make sense of who they are and what they'd like to be, and thus the generation of these vocabularies, which are already out there. So vocation speaks importantly to me, obviously due to my own autobiography, as having been reared in a Christian home and having studied theology and being a Lutheran, which is, you know, something that really does inform my understanding of vocation, the kind of Lutheran tradition. On the other hand, I became very enamored in college and in teaching with Aristotle and the whole discourse on virtue, which I think is, you know, just very important. And then, of course, the whole business of authenticity. I have to listen to myself and be true to myself above all things, really overtook the younger generation several years ago and still remains. The only thing I need to test about what it means to be a good life is whether it's really what I want to do. So if I want to find out what's worth doing, I have to consult my own heart. Exemplarity, Dorothy and I had always been looking for a way to capture what we felt was missing, namely that a lot of people think about these questions with respect to certain models or heroes or heroines that they look up to. And so for a long time, we were kicking around the notion of the other vocabulary being heroism or something like that. Until we got to Collegeville, where we have been graciously received twice, well, more than twice, but once when we did the first edition, and then again as we were working on this one, and the Collegeville Institute in Collegeville, Minnesota, on the campus of St. John's College, hosts a number of scholars who together read one another's work as they're doing it. And we happen to be next door to a man, Craig Boyd, from St. Louis University, who taught philosophy. And when he learned about this fumbling around we were doing to find a name for and how to organize this new vocabulary that we added, he said, oh, well, you should look at Linda Zagzebski's book on exemplarity, because this is kind of a new subschool within virtue ethics. And thankfully, he happened to live next door. You know how a lot of scholarly breakthroughs are just accidental. And this was a great accident that we happened to be living next to him. And then he put me on to that literature. And I had known Zagzebski, actually, because she'd been a senior fellow here, but had lost track of her in the Lilly Fellows program that I direct. But anyway, once we found that vocabulary and looked at that work, it fit right in and captured what we wanted to do. And then it was fun to think of new readings to put under that heading. It was a lot of fun to discover those. Yeah.
And let me say, the three texts that are under that heading are three, which are new to the book, are three of my favorites. And I think are very pedagogically promising and rich. You're asking, do I admire so-and-so and why? And we have Dorothy Day pondering that. Do I admire St. Teresa of Lisieux, the little flower? And she goes through her whole process of thinking, to thinking at first, no, I don't. And then later, as she gains more depth in her own spirituality and more contact with the poor, well, yes, I do. And she explains thinking that through, and it's a really interesting piece. It was in the previous book, though, in a different section. We also have Gordon Marino, who teaches philosophy at St. Olaf College, pondering what he thinks of Muhammad Ali. He admires him very much, it turns out, but he has to work through that, you know, and think through it. And then Madeline Miller, this wonderful novelist who writes about the classical world, about, do you admire Odysseus? Why? How has that happened at different periods in time? Why is it more admirable at some times and not so admirable at others? So I think that models a kind of conversation that really takes place in classrooms. Shall we admire this person? Who do you admire? Why? And it does get you a certain distance towards some deep conversation about what makes a life meaningful, what makes a life significant when we ask what we admire. So I really think that adds a lot pedagogically as well as conceptually to the book.
We wanted to ask you about some of your own teaching stories with these texts, maybe going back to the original work on it or over the years. Mark, listening to you describe the vocabularies reminded me of, for several years I taught the first edition in the context of a junior year course at Monmouth College on vocation. And so, you know, early on I'd be sketching on the board the three vocabularies and trying to get the students to even understand what it means that there is a certain vocabulary about how we speak and think about something. And here's another one, and here's another one. And, you know, these were not philosophy students. This is general education. They were wrestling with that. But first of all, as I said in my review, I really appreciated that the way the book was structured gave me a chance to even get students in the context of this general education class to be even thinking and become a little bit self-aware about their own vocabularies. And the authenticity one, you know, I felt like if they got nothing out of this class, it's to have a light bulb go off when they either themselves or in the world encounter the language of authenticity, you know, what it makes possible and also its limitations. Anyway, when we were wrestling with that, they were sort of, you know, scowling, and I think they weren't exactly sure what I was talking about. And you just reminded me that one student sort of raised their hand and said, "Wait, Professor Schell, you're sort of talking about like you do you." And I had actually never heard that phrase before at that point, but you know, it was pretty clear what it meant. I'm like, yeah, that's exactly what it is. You do you. If your whole life and how you decide what you're going to do comes down to you do you. Anyway, and they all, you know, wrote that down. And that was something they certainly understood. So anyway, thank you for that. And on behalf of all of those students, and I don't know what they did with that insight, but are there, when you think about the texts in the first edition or the second edition, probably this is more likely in the first, that you taught, do you have some teaching stories about, you know, the effect that it had in the classroom or on students, either favorite ones or maybe ones that didn't work? I mean, I remember the autobiography of Malcolm X, the story of him encountering Mr. Ostrowski, that really gave my students pause. You know, both the white students, this was before we even really spoke in the language of white privilege, which is like, oh, wow, I didn't have that experience, but I can begin to imagine what that might feel like. And then the students of color in the classroom were like, yes, I know what that feels like. So thank you for that. But do you have your own stories about teaching certain texts?
I think that the I had the most success with, once it was discovered and unearthed, or had a great deal of success with, is the interview between Bill Moyers and Martha Nussbaum when they are talking about this whole matter of the character of human life among especially people who want to live well and wisely, that they're going to face necessarily some rather tragic situations by which we have, having to do with their own finitude, that they can't be every place at once. So Martha Nussbaum, in that interview, and this is why our Christ College students who read the great books when they're freshmen love this, starts with Bill Moyers, and this is located under this whole question of whether you can lead a balanced life or not, and basically talks about Agamemnon being in a terrible situation of having to sacrifice his own daughter or have the whole fleet that he's leading be moored and perhaps a lot more people dying. Those are his only choices. And Nussbaum basically goes on to say, because Moyer says, but what could this have to do with an ordinary human being? We don't face things like that. And she says, oh yes, all the time. I have to either be at the conference or at my daughter's piano recital. So am I going to sacrifice her in some sense by my not being in the audience so that I can go to the conference? Or am I going to shortchange my professional life and let down people there that I was supposed to be addressing for the sake of being at the conference? And so she basically wants to say, against the social science, we can just size up and solve this if we have our priorities straight. No. There's something about the fabric of human life among people who want to live well that is going to naturally present these little mini tragedies all the time. And we have to recognize that. And of course, this went over big with our students because then they wanted to take this next step that Martha Nussbaum didn't and say something like, we've got to go beyond simply understanding that tragic condition. We've got to have something like forgiveness so that we can wind up living with it well, not just enduring it stoically, but actually having a way to manage those conflicts that are invariably going to arise and be painful. The students love that because they normally thought or invited to think that if they just got their priorities straight and were clear about what's important and what's not, everything would be fine. And they knew that that wasn't true just because of daily life. And somehow this really spoke to them. And I had the most success, I think, teaching that because it took as its point of departure classic work of literature.
Mm-hmm. And let me add, there's one more stirring piece to that, which is that Nussbaum says yes, there's tragedy, but live in such a way that tragedy will happen to you.
Yeah.
I mean, she encourages us to throw ourselves into life, even though there will be some tragedy. And I think in a Christian sense, we could take that in the same way further that Mark said. Yes, we will need forgiveness and we will need to give forgiveness. But let's not live timidly and fail to do things because it might be a conflict. There's another text that I would mention that has been very rich. Robert Frost's poem, Two Tramps in Mud Time, which we have used every year since we first encountered it, probably 15 years now, at the beginning of the year in a faculty development seminar where we gather with some senior faculty and also with our postdoctoral fellows and think about the work of the year that lies ahead. And in this poem, Frost is really interested in the question between working for money and working for love. And it's a very rich and complex poem. You can have a wonderful conversation about it. Our narrator wants to work for both love and money, but it sets it in a stage where you can see the pressures of money on all of us and our love of our work as itself a beautiful and wonderful thing. And I think that professors often, we hope that we can have both of those, as the narrator does. And that is not seen as impossible, but it's really interesting how the tensions in the poem allow us to think about those two different aspects of our work.
I think that the anthology, get back to the teaching matter, in general works well because the readings are short. And you're teaching students to read and think carefully and closely about smaller texts rather than giving them War and Peace and having them not read it carefully and not think about it closely. So these small lyric poems, like the one that Dorothy just mentioned, Two Tramps in Mud Time, you could say the same for the other Frost poem, The Road Not Taken. You could say that for all of the African-American poetry that's in the chapter on the environment that we've already mentioned. And also the short essays that look simple, but you invite with good questions the students to think through them. And very quickly, they are drawn into an interesting conversation simply because the reading hasn't been so sprawling and daunting, but very focused, they can go more deeply into it. And so that's been gratifying with almost all of the texts, that the students actually read them and think about them because they're not, you know, 400 pages that they need to get ready for next Wednesday, that kind of thing.
So as we continue to talk about the changes to this edition, I think one really important change is the moving of Vincent Harding's piece, I Hear Them Calling, to the front of the collection. And that brings up a question about the intention to expand the diversity of voices that are included here. We're wondering if you can talk a little bit about your view about why diversifying the voices to include more women, writers of color, different topics, different disciplines, why this diversity is important and relevant to our understanding of vocation now?
Well, I mean, I think it was important to both of us right away not to be simply picking writers of color or writers of other religions than Christianity simply because it's, quote, the thing to do. We believe firmly and discovered that our belief was borne out throughout the time we were doing the research, that there are any number of questions that can't be well addressed and well considered unless you have that diversity of perspectives. They just can't be. I think that when I was working on the environment chapter, for example, to discover that whole vein of Black nature poetry, and to realize, thanks to the very helpful introduction to the collection Black Nature, from which a lot of those are taken, that African Americans naturally have, given their historic relationship to the land, a very different consciousness of nature from people who were not once enslaved, largely because their relationship to the land was necessarily one of struggle and pain often, not the kind of idyllic retreat that the romantic poems could go out and rhapsodize about. And how that aspect that's brought to us by the African-American poets is particularly since they experience nature often under the whip of oppression and all kinds of threatening machinery, that turns out to be about as relevant and pertinent now to the way we're thinking about our planet than some of the romantic rhapsodies, et cetera. So there's a case where a whole vein of literature, not just one or another poem, turns out to bring to bear upon a very important public matter in thinking about how we're going to live in a time of planetary peril that would simply have been absent altogether from the anthology had we not tapped into that.
Similarly, in the new chapter that's called With Whom and For Whom Shall I Live, shorthand community. It would be wrong to be sentimental about the formation of community. We showed this as an urgent human question, which is often very threatened and fragile. And so there's a wonderful short story by Toni Morrison about friendship, in which racial themes play very strong. And it tells us something different about friendship than we would have known without that. Similarly, a shorter excerpt by Jhumpa Lahiri, the wonderful novelist, about how an immigrant would feel, how she as the child of immigrants felt torn between the Indian culture that her parents valued and the American community that she wished to join. We also include there Martin Luther King's great passage about the world house in which we all live together and depend upon one another. So I think that as Mark said, it's intrinsic to properly considering a large question, like a question of community. You can't do it well without that. There were other places where a question that we, for instance, the last chapter, How Shall I Tell the Story of My Life? Which is largely unchanged, which I think is a very fine chapter. It was in the last book as well. For the sake of representation, I went looking for authors of color and women. I went for that reason, I confess. But the texts that we found make the chapter so much better for everyone. I mean, it's really remarkable. One is by Julia Alvarez, who's known as an author, a novelist, about the role that the story of Scheherazade played for her as a little girl. And you ask the question, what are the formative stories that have shaped your life? And the other by Alice Walker, another novelist, African-American, who writes about her need for a role model if she was to fulfill her life vocation. And they're both beautiful little essays, which shed light for everyone on the topic under consideration.
And I think that chapter is extremely important, largely because a lot of the discourse in whatever vocabulary it's cast, always have the notion that our lives are what they are because of the choices we make rather than what we make of those choices. the work of the imagination in what we make of the choices and how we understand them as part of a larger inner narrative of identity is diminished, and our own authorship in making choices and how we go about making them responsibly, that's very important, but it's not the only part of the picture. And not very many people who talk about this whole large set of questions attend as carefully as they need to what we make of our choices, right along with what are the choices we make.
Yeah, and this question of choice, I think, is really important, because there are some that say that the attention to vocation is a luxury that we can't afford right now. We have students who are food insecure, potentially ill-prepared or underprepared for college, who are serving as primary caregivers, breadwinners for their families, not to mention all of the other wider national and global crises that you've already mentioned. We're wondering if you would be able to, or willing to talk about the idea of, is vocation a luxury? This is considering vocation and entering in these conversations something that is saved for a particular group of people in a particular time, or how do we talk about it in these times of crises and sort of in a wider context with people's real life and on the ground struggles?
It's an important question, which we know that many students especially ask. That becomes a problem primarily if you equate vocation and job, I think. That it's true that many people cannot choose what work they will do. But it is also true that all work has some kind of meaning and significance. And that thinking about how we understand what we are doing is really important. That's what the various vocabularies are important. It's possible that the tyranny of authenticity in our culture would work against satisfaction and meaning for those who are forced to work in jobs they don't particularly desire or value. But the idea of vocation can help them give meaning to that and also move on towards the next possibilities for their life. There are some texts in the first chapter, which is called "Must My Job Be the Source of My Identity?" that directly address this. Do you want to take over here?
No, I think that that's correct. The book addresses this concern, which is very real and very important in many different ways. I think the most extensive way it addresses it is the question of whether our work is the primary source of our identity or should be. And the reminder in that context that one is stationed as parent, as child, as sibling, as citizen, in addition to being stationed in a place of paid employment. And there are plenty of people who find the primary sources of their meaning and purpose outside of their paid employment. Their paid employment, they work in order to live. They don't live in order to work. And thus the Dorothy Sayers reading and other things that make that distinction. So that's one way we attack this problem of choice as being a luxury. It's a problem, as Dorothy said, if and only if you think your vocation is always coextensive with your paid employment. The other way we do it is something, again, that if I had to pick one reading that I think every student needs to confront, it's C.S. Lewis's Learning in Wartime, which the students are shocked to see they have a vocation right now. They think they're in college discerning or preparing for a vocation, which is, you know, tomorrow or 10 years from now. And the C.S. Lewis reading has the great virtue of showing them, wait a minute, you're not here preparing for tomorrow always. You have a vocation right now. What does it mean to live out your vocation as student in a good and responsible way? Well, that helps to reorient right away this whole thinking of making your vocation coextensive with your eventual paid employment. They're not being paid to be students, but here they are. And that means they're called to be students right now, even in the midst of wartime when Lewis wrote that essay.
Aaron and I are smiling foolishly because our colleague, NetView colleague, Jason Stevens, who's at Cornerstone, actually wrote about Lewis's essay at the beginning of the summer, just in his own, how he was responding as a teacher and how he was changing up the text, you know, in the craziness of wrapping up the spring semester, and then sort of offering his thoughts about what that essay meant to his students, you know, in the middle of the pandemic, just this sense of, you know, sort of upheaval and history changing and, you know, this is your life right now. What does that mean? And that has been has continued through the summer to get a lot of traffic on the blog.
Oh, good.
So I think I can tell you that a lot of people are thinking about C.S. Lewis and vocations. You're definitely onto something that people are responding to as teachers and students, I think. I wanted to go back to this new section where you pose a question about the environment, which you had spoken about previously, but I wanted to take that in a slightly different direction. You know, sometimes that's phrased as an explicitly sort of ethical question. What do we owe future generations? I guess I'm wondering if you have thoughts about that as more of an existential question, because I do think that young adults are wrestling with, you know, a kind of a grief about the state of the planet, despair. I think there's a strong temptation towards nihilism. There's anger at, their parents and grandparents, and that all of that then influences their sense of their own futures, what's possible, you know, whether or not to even have something as fancy sounding as a vocation. And I don't know if that resonates at all with what you were thinking about him. Yeah. So if you'd like to say more about that section, please do.
Sure. I mean, what the section is designed to do, even though it's phrased more in an ethical way, as you noticed there, is to raise this whole existential matter. Largely, it ties back into what we were just talking about, in that what happens when you raise that up is that you suddenly come to see that how the students live in their daily life, what they consume, whether or not they are finding work where they can telecommute or they're commuting and adding to the carbon footprint, all kinds of things play in now to the way they think about their lives in a planet in peril, and also those locations where they can do something about it. It may be that they can't do much about it in terms of their paid employment, but it may be they can do a lot about it in terms of their family life, their consumption patterns, their travel patterns, all of the rest. So it may be in their roles as citizens and parents and so forth, that they really address and do something about this larger matter, rather than simply through the work they choose to do. So instead of despairing that they can't really do much about it in their work as arc welders, they can instead see whatever work they happen to do that's not directly related in some self-evident way to improving the environment or conserving it. They can certainly do that in these other places that they're stationed.
I would add that your use of the word existential is really right and important, and that in humanities study, in liberal arts study, thinking about questions such as who are we humans within this natural world? Who are we? Even more than what can I recycle? You know, is one of the things that a college education can contribute to their growth as citizens and what they will do in the future about this concern. This is not an ecology class, but think of what Pope Francis says in Laudato Si, you know, about the great common brotherhood and sisterhood we have with all creation. You know, I mean, this is a really important perspective on who we are and the meaning and significance of our lives that is rightly encountered in something like a general education in the humanities as we grow into realizing who we are in this world. So it may not be specific environmental action, but I think it's really important philosophically, theologically, and humanistically to place ourselves, to understand to think about where we fit, who we are in this great creation.
Yeah, we selected the readings in there with an eye toward not deciding an ethical matter, but toward accomplishing the beginnings of a change in consciousness.
Yes.
Because we think, and if you read that introduction, it does raise, though it doesn't use the word existential, that fundamental question of existence and how best to understand it, this change in consciousness of our being an integral part of a larger web of life, not an anthropocentric view any longer of the world. And that comes through in Larry's letter, comes through in Laudato Si. Imaginative literature always does something to invite a change of consciousness. But that's really what's required underneath all of the proposed policy changes and so forth that has to flow from.
Yes.
We want to shift to asking the two of you some more global, but also some more personal questions. I think most of our listeners will really recognize the two of you through your collective work, not just in this volume, but in your individual scholarship and teaching over the years as leaders in the scholarship of vocation and in teaching and formation of faculty and students. We're wondering about your understanding of mentorship and how you understand your role and influence as a mentor to students. What are your hopes for young adults today, given the complexity of our world? If you had to offer a word or a bit of advice to a young adult who is struggling in discerning their vocation, what would you say?
We may need a minute on this.
Well, I mean, I think that the advice that I would give is to first acknowledge that the world they live in is in some ways much more perilous for many reasons, some of which we've just been talking about, planetary peril, than at other times in history. And what they want to do is to find the good courage to go forth. That's an important virtue, by the way. Good courage and hope that they're going to need to function well in whatever they choose to do and whomever they choose to marry or not and everything else. They're going to need a kind of communal trust in discovering support people, whether it's whom they choose to spend the rest of their life with, or their network of friends, or their churches, et cetera. They're going to need that kind of communal solidarity that can nurture those practices of encouragement and support in what is bound to be an unpredictable situation. So it's not that I would advise them to do this or that. I'd advise them to locate and sometimes create, when they move to a new place, those communities of character that can help to sustain and encourage and nurture within them those virtues I mentioned, courage and hope, that are going to be necessary to go forward. So that's one of the things I would say, most importantly, that they do that, and that they turn to others in times of despair and in times of cluelessness as to whether they even have a future, much less what to do with it, because they need to recognize, which is why we added that chapter on community, that this is something that it's perilous to think of as a private, individual, lonely matter. So they have to change their thinking, not only along the lines we were talking about just a moment ago, in terms of their relationship to the larger web of life, but they also, I think, are going to have to learn to rely more and more on communities of character and support that can sustain those practices and virtues that'll get them through these times.
I think that's right. I would primarily say find people who can be your companions and your fellow risk takers and fellow community builders as you go forward. I think there's a combination of being grounded and rooted and being open to the future and expansive that's needed at this time. One proposal that this book makes is that there is some wisdom. People have been thinking about these things for a long time. You're not the first to think of them, even though I do think your situation is especially perilous. But look to some ancient wisdom as well. But don't get stuck in your tribe. Don't get stuck only with your rootedness. Look beyond your own tribe for companions. Listen to some new ideas as well. And I think that the book makes that claim and offers that hope too, that we will each look beyond only the wisdom of our own birth community and look to the wisdom of others and form relationships with those others that will be for our good, for their good, and for the good of the world.
Mm-hmm. We're sort of wrapping up. We have two more questions for you. You know, there's some people who, when they write about vocation, they use metaphors of life seasons. And so how do each of you understand your current vocational identity? How has your thinking about vocation changed within the seasons of your life? You know, those are very large questions. You can take them out whatever direction you want.
I think I'll speak first. I mean, there's been a very good book that Kathleen Cahalan edited. What's the name of that book?
Calling All Years Good.
Calling All Years Good. And it takes wonderful account with interspersed biblical interludes, which I love, of this very issue that you raised. I myself, personally, find much more continuity than change in my own sense of vocation. I think that once, and I should write an essay on this, vocation is often framed too specifically in terms of inviting someone to think, I'm called to be a doctor, rather than I'm called to be a caregiver, or I'm called to be a healthcare provider, okay? And I think that once I understood that I had been called to be an educator, then the location in which I was doing that educating and the people with whom I was doing that educating, or the form that educating took, classroom teaching, writing books, setting the table for people to have interesting conversations, being with my grandkids, et cetera, et cetera. So what remained constant for me through all the seasons of life and has not changed a whit is this sense that I've been called to be an educator. What changes is the venue. What changes is the social location in which I carry that forward. what changes in the medium in which I do it, whether it's writing or whether it's face-to-face counsel or whether it's conversation in a whatever. But in other words, teaching a Bible class at church. And so for me, there's greater continuity than change in the seasons of life, albeit that there are the changes I named. There's the overarching sense of myself as an educator.
And I have had a very consistent through line sense of vocation as well, really since college, though it took me a while to name it. And it has not so much to do with function as with a content that I love, which is trying to share Christian tradition in a way that's lively and life-giving to people today. And I would have said that when I was a seminary professor in 1981. And I would have said that as a mother. And I've said that through my writings. I hope I've lived that out. And now it's still just as relevant as can be. We're more active in our congregation now. We've always been church members, but we're more active now and giving more in that way. And it feels good. It's fine. You know, the different seasons, different institutions have become available to us, but the task has been pretty consistent.
Mark Schwain and Dorothy Bass, thank you for your time today and for sharing your insights about vocation and higher education, mentoring, living a life that matters. We congratulate you on the publication of the second edition of Leading Lives That Matter, What We Should Do and Who We Should Be.
So interesting to hear the confluence of things that came together to make the first edition, and then now the thinking behind the second edition. I mean, stretching back to the original grant and then the experience at Collegeville, their process as a couple and sort of editing back and forth. Very helpful advice there.
Yeah, I think that the interview really shows why this book has worked in the classroom for so many years, why faculty continue to go back to the readings, and the wide and expansive approach that Mark and Dorothy have taken to the project over many years by listening to students, listening to stories from how it works in the classroom, listening to other scholars give them suggestions. The model that they give of scholarship here was really insightful.
Yes. Yeah, I had forgotten that the first edition really was workshopped with students, right? And they just gave us a little bit more insight into that of actually sending students out and pursuing questions. So, you know, what a great project. So the other thing is each of their answers to the question about seasons, right, which they actually both came back with a version of, they understand their lives, their vocations much more in terms of narrative of continuity. But they're not the same calling, right? But when you think about Mark Schwain and his calling as first and foremost as a teacher, and then I think Dorothy described hers as really talking about what it is to live out as a Christian and to, you know, also be doing that in a teacher capacity, you can see how both of those callings really inform this incredible collection, you know? So it's...
And their influence and I think combined aura in conversation, but also in the true substance of their answers is just a testimony to their influence on many scholars and students and their communities and people around them. And I just was really enjoying that particular part of talking with both of them together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Dorothy joked or said that there will not be a third edition, but I think I also heard her say there already is a file because they are constantly coming across new pieces. So people in the NetView world, maybe be thinking about what would you put in the third edition, because it's just the project itself is so important. It's going to need to be refreshed and updated as the years go on. So.
And from all of us in the NetView community and beyond, we want to thank Mark and Dorothy for the resource that they have provided all of us through this volume, but also through their wide scholarship and legacy of teaching. And to our listeners, we wish you the best on your journey in pursuing the life well lived. Until next time.
Callings is hosted by NetView, the Network for Vocation in Undergraduate Education, an association of over 250 colleges and universities in the U.S. and Canada. NetView is administered by the Council of Independent Colleges and is funded through member dues and generous support from Lilly Endowment, Inc. Your hosts were Hannah Schell and Aaron Van Lanningham, with audio support provided by Caleb Kennedy. You can find our library of podcasts at netview.buzzsprout.com. Additional resources about vocation in undergraduate education can be found at NetView's blog, vocationmatters.org, and at the NetView program page at the Council of Independent Colleges website, www.cic.edu. Our music was composed by Dan Kennedy. Thank you for listening.
Listeners may also be interested in our inaugural episode, A Conversation with Shirley Rules, who was the founding director of NetView and currently serves as the executive director of the International Network for Christian Higher Education. In the coming weeks, look for interviews featuring Darby Ray, co-director of the NetView Faculty Development Seminar, talking about the intersection between community engagement and vocation, and Eboo Patel, founder and president of the Interfaith Youth Corps. All episodes are available on NetView's Buzzsprout site and through most podcast directories.